Abraham Verghese's new novel, Cutting for Stone, begins with a forbidden love affair between a young South Indian nurse and an English surgeon. Their relationship reveals itself in a catastrophic and arguably miraculous birth that shapes the lives of everyone around them. Mr. Verghese is the author of two best-selling memoirs dealing with his work as a physician, and he's also a professor at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Cutting for Stone, an epic novel which spans nearly 60 years, is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Verghese back to the show today. Hello.
How are you? Good to be back.
Your novel begins in the wake of Indian independence with a young nun from the Carmelite Order of Madras setting sail from her home in Madras to Yemen, where she and her colleague are charged with spreading Christianity through their nursing. Can you tell us what happens to Sister Mary Joseph Praise during that voyage?
So I begin the book with an image that really has haunted me for a long time and is the genesis of the novel, and that is the idea of a nun from India, a very beautiful nun, giving birth to twins in a mission hospital operating room. And so the book opens with the voyage that she makes with a colleague, and on the voyage there's an outbreak of a fever, and she makes the acquaintance of an English surgeon, Thomas Stone, who is one of the major characters in the book. But the whole notion of a nun from India trying to proselytize in Africa was, I thought, somewhat grand and destined to fail idea for a nun to carry out.
Now, she's not a Catholic nun, but she has also made vows of chastity.
So she is a Catholic nun. She's become a Carmelite nun, converted to Catholicism. And she's,
I thought this was a special order that kind of was like an offshoot of Catholicism.
Well, yes, you're right. It is an offshoot, but I think that they're still considered Catholics. But still the notion of going from India to proselytize in Africa is somewhat ambitious even for a Carmelite order.
Now, why would she, as a nun, develop an intimate relationship with this doctor, her patient?
So I think the idea of a nun has always fascinated everyone, I think, from the time nuns were first in existence. The idea of someone renouncing the world and having this special relationship with God and basically being a bride of Christ, for example, is the term that they use. And I think that the notion that we're all fallible sets this up as a very difficult proposition for anyone to carry out. And I think we're all intrigued by nuns, intrigued by what they renounce. So I think I was fascinated by that idea and wanted to bring her into my story for that reason.
And Dr. Stone's illness allows her to get close to him. She's never had a real relationship with a man on
That's
any
correct.
Level.
That's correct, right. And I really wanted to bring the two of them together and also set them in a mission hospital, because I really like the way that the bare bones of a mission hospital allows you to see the things about medicine that I think are sometimes concealed by all our technology and all our fancy layers of tests and buildings and so on. In that setting, the nature of suffering is really hard to hide, and the relationship and the obligation of a physician becomes very obvious. That's why I chose that setting.
And that was the mission hospital in Addis Ababa, which is often called, it's called the missing hospital.
That's
because
right.
People mispronounce its name.
That's right. So the word mission on the native tongue came out as missing, and at some point a newspaper and the health ministry sort of propagated that misnomer, and it took, and so it became the missing hospital.
She becomes his surgical assistant. Something that comes up several times in the novel is the distinction between curing patients and healing them. What's the difference?
Well, I think we're so obsessed these days in Western medicine with the idea of cure, and we sometimes forget that most ailments also have a sense of violation, which in the old days was the only thing that the physician could address. So the example I often use with my students is if you were to go home after a day in school and find that your door had been kicked down, all your valuables taken, you would be devastated. And if the police came by an hour later and said, "Here's all your stuff back," you would be cured, but you would not be healed. Your sense of violation would linger for many months. You might even move out from that apartment. So I think all illnesses like that, especially, for example, HIV in the early years, a huge spiritual violation and nothing that could be done medically, and yet everything that could be done by simply engaging with the patient.
Well, in the case of that robbery, we might put somebody through some kind of a therapy so that they could be helped. Is that the same sort of thing you would advocate here, or are you talking about something more spiritual a way of healing people?
I'm talking about how even though the patient comes to you ostensibly with a broken finger or a broken leg or a pneumonia, the subtext in their minds is always, why me, why now? And there is also always a subtext of their wanting some sort of reassurance from you. And I think that as physicians, we've become very self-conscious about the whole notion of a ministry of healing. That's what they used to call our profession. And I think that we've become too caught up in the cure and unwilling to admit that this is a very important function we have to transact.
And this is something you've also written about in your previous writings.
Yeah, it's been sort of a monomania with me. I think American medicine, Western medicine, for all its wonderful powers, has this great danger of alienating the public. Patients are increasingly feeling disenfranchised, feeling like care is fragmented, feeling like nobody's listening. And I think we've got to wake up and start paying attention to that. That's important.
The romance between Sister Praise and Dr. Stone reveals itself in a way that's quite shocking. Can you describe how we as readers come to learn about their involvement?
So I wanted the book to have this mystery at the outset, where Sister Mary Joseph Praise shocks this hospital by getting suddenly, well, not pregnant, she's suddenly in labor. That's the first intimation the hospital has that something has gone on between Sister Mary Joseph Praise and somebody. And they assume that that somebody is the surgeon, Thomas Stone, even though they've had a very professional relationship. No one can imagine they're being together. Thomas Stone himself does not deny that he's the father. He knows in his heart of hearts he's probably the father, and yet he has no recollection of an event that could have resulted in his being the father. And therefore, part of the mystery of the book is exactly how that can come about. And I think what I was trying to set up with Thomas Stone is the great danger, the great seduction of medicine is that in the process of working with others and healing others, you can almost lose yourself and not recognize how dysfunctional you yourself are getting and not recognize how much you're alienating your own loved ones.
There's also something peculiar about the way the birth scene is narrated. The narrator is not someone we might expect to be telling this story.
That's right. So the narrator is one of the twins born to this nun. And, you know, this is the voice that informs the book. And later on when the book, when the characters arrive in America, that first-person voice really takes over. And I have this belief that coming to America gives immigrants voices, speaking for myself especially. And so I really wanted the book to sort of open up into that voice when he came across. But before that, he is still the narrator. And if you ask how can a baby who's yet to be born get away with telling the story, I think if it works, it works. And I'm inspired by Günter Grass's wonderful Tin Drum, where Oscar recalls his grandmother's many skirts well before he's born.
We also have Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy doing something
similar.
They're both comic novels written from the perspective of a child. Did you consider whether an infant narrator might introduce a note of comedy into this otherwise tragic scene?
So I never thought of writing this as a comic novel, but there is a lot of humor in it. And for that matter, there's a lot of humor in medicine. Perhaps the stark contrast of the serious events going on in the backdrop can exaggerate the moments of humor, and they surprise me. I hope they surprise the reader, too.
My guest is Abraham Verghese, V-E-R-G-H-E-S-E. His latest book is his first novel. He's written two memoirs. It's called Cutting for Stone, and it is published by Knopf. And we should point out that it is a huge book, an epic book that spans six decades. As we said, it's narrated by one of these two twins, Marion. The other twin's name is Shiva, not a very Christian name.
No, not at all.
Both Grass's and Stern's novels share the idea that the spiritual identity of a person is already defined at birth. Is that something you also had thought about?
In part. I think one of the main themes of the book is that geography is truly destiny. And I think that, you know, it's perfectly illustrated in my life, but also in this novel, where the fact of a character being born in a certain country clearly defines their geography. And the moment they move or they're forced to move, then their destiny changes. So geography is very much destiny. I also wanted the reader to have an experience with this novel that I had as a young man, and I actually felt a calling to medicine because of a book. In my case, it was Of Human Bondage. But I wanted this novel to portray what I think is just the wonderful romance and seduction of studying medicine and all the pitfalls, all the dangers to the self that one can encounter along the way.
So you have a religious calling, or you have a calling of that sort. And these two characters who we started with, Sister Faith, has a devotion to God that's unshakable. There are others here who blame God for allowing a loved one to die. Has your work as a doctor strengthened your faith or caused you at times to question God in the way that Dr. Stone does?
I think there are moments when we all have, you know, very serious questions about why good things happen to, why bad things happen to good people. And, you know, in my line of work, I see that a tremendous amount. But I think I've also come to this notion that, you know, what ultimately survives in human lives, since we're all mortal, what ultimately survives is love. What ultimately survives is the relationships that have lasted for us over a lifetime. And so this book is very much about celebrating those aspects of a mortal life that are indelible, and they are the moments in our relationship, the moments of love and trust.
How much of this novel grows out of the circumstances of your own life? Didn't your parents emigrate from southern India to Ethiopia around the time of partition, at the same time that Sister Praise does in the novel?
Yeah, so the events very much follow the course of my life in terms of the geography, but otherwise not. I don't have parents who were physicians. I don't have a twin. Never was born in a mission hospital and so on. But I thought there was an advantage to describing geography that I knew very well. Being born in Ethiopia, it's a country that I think is easily misunderstood, and people have immediate notions of what Ethiopia means. And I wanted to convey the great beauty of that land and of its people.
Isn't your title taken from the Hippocratic Oath?
Indeed it is. So there is a line in the Hippocratic Oath, which is, "Thou shalt not cut for stone."
And we should point out that we have Dr. Stone, and he is not a surgeon, and he performs this very, very difficult operation.
That's right.
Doesn't do it particularly well, but it works anyway.
It works anyway, yes. So that line is sort of an antique line, and I've always liked the idea of our saying
it. What does it mean, cut for stone?
So the context of that line is bladder stones used to be epidemic in the Middle Ages and even in Victorian society. People walked around with catheters in their top hats to catheterize themselves because these stones were obstructing the bladder. And there were these itinerant people who would go around from city to city and cut and take out the stone. And they did it actually very well, but the trouble was the patient died the next day of infection. And so that dictum came along, "Thou shalt not cut for stone."
Now, what happened to you? In the late 80s, you were a successful doctor and an academic. What made you enroll in the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
So I had lived through an extraordinary period in the early years of HIV, where all of us were confronted with this very terrible disease, ultimately fatal. There was no treatment.
And you've written a memoir about that.
I wrote a memoir about that, and I felt that that work was really my calling. I felt very very satisfied by it, but there's a great danger of burnout, and I thought, I want to do this for a lifetime, and in order to do that, it's important to take breaks. And my way of taking a break was to do a sabbatical of sorts by attending the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I still saw patients in a clinic once a week in Iowa, but it was a wonderful way for me to step back and make sense of what had been an extraordinary period in my life. But I very quickly went back to full-time medicine, which is what I do now.
And but you still write, and obviously writing a book that's 533 pages or something like that long had to take some time.
It takes a lot of time. It took me many more years than I think it would take someone who writes full-time. But I feel completely that my identity is really that of a physician, and the writing comes from that.
Are you also concerned about showing how medicine has changed over the years and setting part of this in a hospital 60 years ago? You're describing physicians relying on bedside manner a lot more than they do today.
That's exactly right. But then I do bring it almost to a contemporary era.
2003.
Right, exactly. And I think that what hasn't changed is the seduction of technology, whether it was 50 years ago or now. And I think the great danger of all our wonderful technology is that the patient is getting even more and more remote. I talk about the patient in the bed becoming an icon for the real patient who's in the computer.
But we also practice medicine in some places. We don't have as much technology as we do elsewhere. If you're practicing in the bush, for example, you have to have a lot more skills than if you are in an operating room in a major city hospital where you have 25 people assisting you.
Absolutely. I sometimes say that if someone's missing a finger and they come to our hospital, no one will believe them till they get an MRI and a bone scan and a CAT scan. We have come to distrust our senses. But when our students go abroad and work in international arenas, which they all love to do, they quickly realize how important it is to have those basic skills and how much it can really tell you. It's a tremendous skill that is in danger of dying.
What were you hoping to achieve in writing a work of fiction rather than another memoir? Because you could have discussed many of these ideas in a memoir or in a book of essays.
True. My first love was always fiction, and I would make the thesis that you can come to a truth even more strongly in fiction than in nonfiction. I love a quote by Dorothy Allison. She says that fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world really lives. So if I've created an authentic world, an authentic life or lives, then at the end of it, certain truths emerge that I hope will shake the reader, transform the reader, hopefully edify the reader. And I think fiction is a great way to do just that.
I should correct myself a little bit. Sometimes, even working in this country, like your experience in Johnson City, Tennessee, reveals that you sometimes have to perform medicine without a lot of technology at hand. Just one more question. With what your statement about fiction in mind, what will your next project be, another memoir or another work of fiction?
You know, honestly, Leonard, I feel like I put everything I know into this particular book, and I really can't think ahead and say what's next. I know there's a great pressure to come up with a follow-up, but I feel very content with this, and now I have to wait for the tank to fill up again.
Dr. Abraham Verghese will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 p.m. at Idlewild Books. That's at 12 West 19th Street. The book, Cutting for Stone, is published by Knopf, and I want to thank you so much for coming back again to
the show.
Thank
you for having me.